question of creation and evolution and the laws of science. Each one of our models, the creation model and the evolution model, must be true to its source. The creation model is based upon the existence of God, a person who is real, a God who is the creator, a God who is the sustainer of this universe, a God who is omniscient and omnipotent and omnipresent. That the creation model is basically, you see, rooted in that concept, and it is true to its source. It appeals to supernatural processes. It says that God used processes which are not in operation today. It says that this whole subject of origins is outside of the domain of science. It cannot be investigated within the limits of empirical science. Now, the theory of evolution, on the other hand, must be true to its source. It said it is scientific, that it is appealing to processes that are in operation today, that have always been operating from the very start. Throughout this entire universe, the universe is a universe. Everything operating here within our solar system is operating throughout all other parts of the universe. Processes which brought the stars and planets into existence and our living things into existence are purely mechanistic, naturalistic processes. Therefore, the theory of evolution and the predictions that we make on the basis of the theory of evolution must be in accord with what we find operating in the real world right now. And if evolution is true to its source, if the theory of evolution is true to its source, the evolutionist cannot appeal beyond known physical processes. It's not scientific. It's not true to its source to appeal to something that may exist way out in space beyond where we can investigate and see and try, or way back in time before there was any possibility of observations. That takes it beyond the realm of science. The theory of evolution, those who advocate this theory, must be true to their source. It must be purely mechanistic, rationalistic, naturalistic processes, and they must be operating today. So each must be true to its source. Now, if that is so, then the predictions that we make on the basis of the theory of evolution must be supported by the actual scientific evidence, the laws of thermodynamics, the laws of probability. All natural laws must be in accord with this theory, with the predictions made on the basis of the theory. On the other hand, creation must be true to its source. And what prediction we could make about what we would expect to find in the real world must be in accord with this concept of creation. Now, we're going to compare this morning the two concepts, creation and evolution, to the known scientific evidence, and see whether the concept, the predictions based upon these concepts, are in accord with the scientific evidence. Which model seems to fit the known fact? Now, I mentioned last night that evolution is really no more scientific than creation, and intrinsically it is just as religious. And I said I'd make an attempt today to document that statement in somewhat more detail. Now, I pointed out last evening that the example of the peppered moths, which have been said by leading evolutionists to be the most striking example of evolution ever seen by man, is no example of evolution at all. There was no origin of one basic kind from another. There was no increase in complexity. There was no origin even of a new species. These peppered moths, from beginning to end, remain peppered moths, Bistan betularia. So even on the basis of the testimony of the evolutionists themselves, here is the most striking example of evolution ever seen by man, it is not any real evolutionary change at all. It is just as much a part of the creation model as it is the evolution model. Now, we could bring up other examples and testimony to the fact that evolution is really not a scientific theory. Now, you see, a scientific theory or the scientific method involves observation, hypothesis, and test. You must be able to observe, you must be able to see the processes, the events, or the properties that you are using to support your theory. If you can't see it, it's not science. Well, it's quite obvious then that creation is not a scientific theory. There were no human witnesses to the creation of the universe, the creation of the planet Earth, to the creation of life, or the creation of any living thing. No one has ever seen anything like that happen. Creation is not occurring today. It's not an ongoing process that we can test, that we can observe. But the same is true of evolution. For you see, however the universe came into being, however life arose on this planet, as a matter of fact, however any living thing came to be, there were no human witnesses. I'm sure I've never seen a fish evolve into an amphibian. And I don't suppose you've seen an ape evolve into a man. No. These were historical events. There were no human observers. They're not repeatable. They're not reversible. Let me quote from Dr. Theodosius Dobzhansky. Before his death, just very recently, Dr. Dobzhansky was one of the world's leading evolutionists, certainly within the top half dozen. Very strong evolutionist. Had no time for the creationist. Didn't care to hear what we had to say or what we had to write. Dr. Dobzhansky, in an article published in American Scientist, Volume 45, December of 1957, on page 388, made the following statement. He said, quote, "These evolutionary happenings are unique, unrepeatable, and irreversible. It is as impossible to turn a land vertebrate into a fish as it is to effect the reverse transformation. The applicability of the experimental method to the study of such unique historical processes is severely restricted, before all else, by the time intervals involved, which far exceed the lifetime of any human experimenter. And yet, it is just such impossibility that is demanded by anti-evolutionists when they ask for proofs of evolution which they would magnanimously accept as satisfactory." Unquote. Now notice that Dr. Dobzhansky is saying that when these creationists demand such proof, the applicability of the experimental method to evolution, they are demanding the impossibility, the impossible. He says it's just such impossibility that is demanded by anti-evolutionists. He's referring to creationists. He says it's an impossibility. You cannot apply the experimental method to the study of evolution. It takes too long. It takes tens of thousands of years, hundreds of thousands of years, for these evolutionary changes to take place. You cannot apply the experimental method. That is just extremely unreasonable for creation to demand such a thing. But isn't it rather amazing that Dr. Dobzhansky and other leading evolutionists are demanding that creation be excluded as an explanation for origins? Why? Because it's impossible to apply the experimental method to creation. Therefore, it must be excluded. But he says it's impossible to apply the same scientific method, you see, to the study of evolution. It's impossible. There's no experiment that anyone could design and perform and gather the data and decide on the basis of that experiment whether evolution is true or not. It's impossible. As Dr. Dobzhansky says, you can't study an evolutionary process within the lifetime of any human experimenter. As a matter of fact, in the lifetime of dozens of human experimenters, one after the other, it takes tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of years for these changes to take place, if they do take place. No scientist has 100,000 years to observe any scientific experiment. Evolution has been postulated, but it's never been observed. There's no way to test the theory. Let me use one more source. Dr. Paul Ehrlich of Stanford University, and Dr. L.C. Birch a biologist at the University of Sydney. They summarized the problem in this way in an article published in Nature, the British Science Journal, April 22, 1967. They said, quote, "Our theory of evolution has become one which cannot be refuted by any possible observations. Every conceivable observation can be fitted into it." Now, let me stop right there. Now, that really makes evolution sound like a great theory, doesn't it? But you see, exactly the same can be said of creation. Any conceivable observation can be fitted within this concept of creation. Evolution today has been made so plastic, has been modified in so many different ways, there are so many secondary and tertiary assumptions been brought in to explain apparently contradictory data, that it can be used to explain anything. It's a non-falsifiable theory. That's what Dr. Karl Popper, one of the leading philosophers in the area of philosophy of science, he says evolution is a non-falsifiable theory. And other evolutionists have criticized the theory of evolution. They said, we've made it so plastic that it doesn't make any difference what the data is. What the evidence is, it fits. Let me give you one example. The example of homology, the possession of common structures, structures in common. We have four limbs that are similar to the four limbs of reptiles and birds and amphibians. And so then the evolution says, see, that's evidence of evolution. That's evidence that we've come from a common ancestor. We have inherited these similar structures from a common ancestor. But there's many, many similar structures possessed by various animals which was not possessed by the postulated common ancestor. Many, many examples. Here we have animals possessing certain structures in common, but the postulated common ancestor doesn't possess those structures. Now, it's quite evident, is it not, that these animals do not possess these structures in common because they inherited them from a common ancestor, because the postulated common ancestor doesn't even have them. Well, what does the evolutionist explain this to? How does he explain this data? Well, he says that these animals diverged from this common ancestor, and later on, each one acquired the structure in common, independently, by independent evolutionary processes, by parallel evolution. There's other examples where animals have supposedly had a very remote common ancestor, way back hundreds of millions of years ago, that now have certain structures in common that were not possessed by any of these so-called common ancestors. The eye, for example, possessed by the vertebrates, the vertebrate eye, the eye of the squid, the arthropod eye. The common ancestor, way back in remote time, didn't have eyes, didn't even have eyes. Now we have these eyes in common. But that's convergent evolution, you see. They evolved these much, much later, independently. Well, you see, the possession of structures in common prove nothing, then, do they? Because even the evolutionist says they don't prove anything as far as common ancestry is concerned. Sometimes animals have structures in common because they inherited from a common ancestor. But many times they have structures in common which they didn't inherit from a common ancestor. They don't possess them because of any evolutionary origin, you see, from a common ancestor. Well, so then, to make all the data fit, we have this ordinary divergent evolution explains structures in common. But then we have parallel evolution, we have convergent evolution, and by the way, we have adaptive evolution. Many structures and organs are possessed in common because of an adaptation to the environment. But there's many structures and organs that cannot be explained on the basis of some adaptation. So now they invent non-adaptive evolution. So we have divergent evolution, we have parallel evolution, we have convergent evolution, we have adaptive evolution, we have non-adaptive evolution. You see, you name it, they've got it. They explain anything and everything. The theory has become non-falsifiable. It explains everything. Now, ladies and gentlemen, the same criticism can be made of creation. You can modify your creation concept. You can bring in secondary assumptions so that you make anything fit, you see. Neither creation nor evolution are falsifiable. Neither fits the criteria of a scientific theory. So these gentlemen say that every conceivable observation can be fitted into it. Then they go on to say, it is thus outside of empirical science. but not necessarily false. All right? It's outside of the empirical science. Empirical science deals with testable science. It deals with things that you observe and that you can test. And they say the theory of evolution is outside of the limits of empirical science. So is creation. Creation is outside the limits of empirical science, but so is evolution. They go on to say, no one can think of ways in which to test it. Ideas, either without basis or based on a few laboratory experiments carried out in extremely simplified systems, have attained currency far beyond their validity. They have become part of an evolutionary dogma accepted by most of us as part of our training. Unquote. So they say that evolution is outside the limits of experimental science. No one can think of ways in which to test it. Well, that's just not a scientific theory then, you see. A scientific theory must be subject to test. The theory of general relativity, the theory of spatial relativity, it makes certain predictions, precise predictions, which can be tested. Now, it may be difficult. Maybe they haven't all been tested yet. But any scientific theory, really scientific theory, makes certain predictions which are testable. And you can falsify the theory. You can demonstrate what is true or not. I'm sorry, you can demonstrate what is false or not. You can never establish beyond any doubt that any theory is true. But you can disprove it. As Einstein said, no matter how many experiments have been designed and carried out to support his theory of relativity or any other theory, someday somebody might perform that experiment that would disprove it. It's always capable of disproof, so you can never prove anything. But what you can do is establish levels of credibility, levels of confidence. And we believe that that can be done in creation and evolution. Whether they're scientific theories or not, there is scientific evidence related to origins. And we believe that this evidence can be used to establish a level of confidence in one or the other. And we believe that when all this evidence is considered, we find the level of confidence in creation is certainly superior to that than confidence in the theory of evolution. We can call them theories. They may not be scientific theories, but they can be called theories, or we prefer to call them models. Now, another point we want to make is that evolution is intrinsically as religious as creation. Yes, it's true. Creation involves the supernatural. Creation requires the existence of God or a creator, the supernatural. But the opposite of theism is atheism. And it is a religious point of view. Let me quote from a pamphlet published by the American Humanist Society. Actually, this particular pamphlet, called What is Humanism, was published by the Humanist Community of San Jose. This pamphlet says that humanism is the belief that man shapes his own destiny. It is a constructive philosophy, a non-theistic religion, a way of life. A little later, it goes on to quoting Sir Julian Huxley. He said, I use the word humanist to mean that someone who believes that man is just as much a natural phenomenon as an animal or plant, that his body, mind, and soul were not supernaturally created, but are products of evolution, and that he's not under the control or guidance of any supernatural being or beings, but has to rely on himself and his own powers. Unquote. That's found in this book, this booklet from the Humanist Society of San Jose. A humanist, one who has a non-theistic religion. A humanist is one who believes that man was not supernaturally created, but he was a product of evolution. Now that, ladies and gentlemen, is a religion. It's a way of looking at the universe. It's a way of looking at all reality. It's just as much as a religion as the one who is a Christian or a Jew or a Muslim or what. But people take this humanistic, secularistic, mechanistic religion and clothe it with this term called science and dignify it by this term science and sell it to our educational and scientific establishment as science. Now, in America, we have a pluralistic society. Our Constitution does not guarantee freedom from religion. It guarantees freedom of religion. But our present system, you see, is a system which amounts to the adoption or promotion of a secular, materialistic, mechanistic philosophy. There is plenty of religion in our public schools today. But it's this philosophy of secular humanism was being promoted, and the creation concept is being excluded because it involves God, it involves a creator. We see that that is wrong. It violates our Constitution, freedom of religion, academic freedom. It does not encourage the students to examine all possibilities, all alternatives. It does not demand the students to think for himself, to take both points of view, review the evidence, and then decide for himself which is right. He is given one in a pre-digested form, and it is demanded that he accept it. Well, be that as it may, one or the other must be true. Whether they're scientific theories or not, whether it can be tested or not, it seems to me one or the other must be true. We got here somehow, and the only two alternatives that I've ever heard about is the concept of creation and evolution. Even if Van Daniken's, you entertain Van Daniken's theory, God's from outer space, they had to arrive, they had to get here somewhere from out there, you see. I mean, they had to rise somehow. Either they were created out there or they evolved out there. We're just transporting the problem to some other planet, you see. We can't get around this basic question of origin. Either we were created or we evolved. So our suggestion, then, as we mentioned last night, is to consider these as two different models. Make predictions on the basis of each model and then review the models and the predictions in the light of the scientific evidence. Now, what about natural laws, the processes that are operating today? What predictions would we make on the basis of the theory of evolution? Well, now, the theory of evolution, the mechanistic naturalistic theory, tells us that matter itself had some inherent capability to self-organize itself and to transform itself from a chaotic, disordered state into higher and higher levels of complexity, to higher and higher levels of order. And this was a natural process. Matter itself did this. Now, if that's true, if that really did happen, you see, we can make some very definite predictions about what we'd expect to find operating in the real world, in the natural world. If this really did happen, if evolution happened the way they said it did, if as say one of the most popular theories of the order of the universe tells us, all the matter and energy in our entire universe was crammed together in some huge cosmic egg of electrons, protons, and neutrons some billions of years ago. Nobody has the foggiest notion where it came from or how it got there, but there it was. And then all of a sudden it exploded, and billions of years later, here we are, human beings, 30 trillion cells in our body, 12 billion brain cells. Each brain cell is connected to 10,000 other brain cells. Incredibly complex arrangement of matter. 120 trillion connections in the human brain alone. If that's happened, if we've gone from those particles, from electrons, protons, and neutrons to people by this process, then matter has to have this intrinsic ability to self-organize itself and to transform itself to higher and higher levels of complexity. If that's true, then scientists should have been able to recognize this property of matter. They would have formalized their observations in some set of natural laws, or a natural law of some kind that describes such properties in thermodynamics and other areas of scientific endeavor. Ladies and gentlemen, there isn't any such law. There is no law known to science in any area of scientific endeavor that describes any such property of matter. There's no law of thermodynamics. There's no law anywhere that recognizes there is based upon the recognition of any such property of matter. Why isn't there? Why don't we have such a natural law? Why don't these laws exist? if this is really an inherent ability of matter. But there is certain properties of matter which have been observed, and as a consequence, scientists have incorporated their observations into what we call a natural law, the laws of thermodynamics. Now, the second law of thermodynamics simply says this, that the more probable state of matter is always the random state. That is, the repeated observations of scientists time after time after time after time, it has never failed. The more probable state of matter is always the random state. Any process that will just occur all by itself, any spontaneously occurring natural process that will go all by itself with no outside intervention or control, always tends to produce disorder. You always tend to have a loss of order. Now, there's a number of different ways we could define the second law of thermodynamics. As far as the tendency of naturally occurring processes to result in the loss of usable energy. Every time you perform work, you lose some of the energy. It's no longer available. If you don't lose it, it's still there, but it's radiated out into space as heat. It's no longer available to do further work. Every time you do anything like this, any process that converts energy into work, you lose some of the energy for further work. As a result of this, everything tends to run downhill. Now, another consequence of these observations, then, is this tendency towards disorder. That is the concept that is basically applicable to our question of creation and evolution. Let me just read from three different sources from evolutionists as to their observations, the operation of the second law. Now, these men are evolutionists, and they believe somehow, sometime, some way, we'll have some explanation of why natural processes seem to go this way and yet evolution was possible. They have this comment. They have to have. They wouldn't be evolutionists. Now, they haven't come up with it yet, and we're confident that they never will. But now listen to what these people say about the second law of thermodynamics. Dr. R.B. Lindsay, an American Scientist, Volume 56, 1968, on page 100, said, quote, "There is a general natural tendency of all observed systems to go from order to disorder, reflecting dissipation of energy available for future transformation, the law of increasing entropy," unquote. So Dr. Lindsay says there's a general natural tendency of all observed systems to go from order to disorder. Dr. Harold Blum, American Scientist, October 1955, on page 595, said, quote, "All real processes go with an increase of entropy. The entropy also measures the randomness or lack of orderliness of the system. The greater the randomness, the greater the entropy," unquote. So Blum says all real processes, everything that happens naturally and spontaneously, go with an increase of entropy. The entropy is the measure of the randomness, the lack of orderliness. So every natural process goes with an increase of entropy or with an increase in disorder. Finally, Dr. Isaac Asimov, in the Smithsonian Institute Journal, June of 1970, on page 6, said, "Another way of stating the second law, then, is the universe is constantly getting more disorderly. Viewed that way, we can see the second law all about us. We have to work hard to straighten a room, but left to itself, it becomes a mess again, very quickly and very easily. Even if we never enter it, it becomes dusty and musty. How difficult to maintain houses and machinery and our own bodies in perfect working order. How easy to let them deteriorate. In fact, all we have to do is nothing. And everything deteriorates, collapses, breaks down, wears out, all by itself. And that is what the second law is all about. Unquote. So Dr. Asimov says, what do we see in nature? What do we see operating in this real world? Everything tends to wear out and run down, become disorderly, all by itself. That's the way things always happen. Our universe is becoming less and less orderly. The fuel in the sun is being exhausted at the rate of 4.5 billion tons a second. That is by the fusion of hydrogen into helium. That is, that's what's postulated. It would be consuming 4.5 billion tons of fuel every second. Well, listen, the sun's not going to last forever. That's quite obvious, is it not? It's going to run down, it's going to burn out and grow cold, and all life sees. Don't hold your breath. It's going to last another 5 billion years or so. But unless God intervenes, that is the absolute destiny of this universe. It's death, complete. Everything is running down. The star clusters are breaking up. You see supernova, stars exploding. You see biological compounds that deteriorate. You have expiration dates on films. You have expiration dates on drugs. If you are a biochemist and you isolate some biochemically active material, you do your best to try to preserve that biological activity, but you can't really do it, not indefinitely. When I was on the staff of Cornell University Medical College, we were working on hormones of the pituitary gland. We'd isolate this material from frozen pituitaries. We'd get it in a pure state, and immediately it'd be put in an ampule, in a desiccator, under vacuum, stored in a deep freeze. We'd do everything we could to preserve the biological activity of that material. But month by month by month, as we tested that material, we could find it was losing its biological activity. There were forces in nature at work to break chemical bonds, to randomize the chemical structures, and to destroy its biological activity. Now, that's what we find occurring all the time in nature. Here's the way things go. As a matter of fact, there's never been an exception. It's a law of science. Well, what about evolution? Well, listen to what Julian Huxley says about the theory of evolution. In his chapter, Evolution and Genetics, in the book, What is Man?, published in 1955. On page 278, Dr. Huxley says, evolution in the extended sense can be defined as a directional and essentially irreversible process occurring in time, which in its course gives rise to an increase of variety and an increasingly high level of organization in its products. Our present knowledge indeed forces us to the view that the whole of reality is evolution, a single process of self-transformation. End quote. All right, here we have then this evolutionary process embracing the whole of reality, from the micro to the macro level, throughout the entire universe. It's a single process of self-transformation which leads to an increasingly high level of organization in its products. But the second law of thermodynamics tells us that throughout this entire universe, throughout the whole of reality, there is a process of self-transformation which leads to a loss of order, to a lower level of complexity in its products. How can these both be true? How can we have one natural process going in this direction and another natural process going in that direction, going in opposite directions? How can they both be true? It seems to me that an evolutionist must cease being a scientist when he talks about evolution. He can't justify any such thing scientifically. Now, creation may be a-scientific. It may be outside the limits of empirical science, but it's not anti-scientific. You see, we believe the only rational scientific explanation then for the origin of our ordered universe and this tremendous complexity to find within it is that there must be a God who is independent of the natural universe, a God who is external to the natural universe, a God who introduced this complexity and order that we find within the universe. since the universe itself could not have done so. It could not have transformed itself, you see, by any natural process known to science, from a chaotic state to an ordered state. The creationist is a better scientist. It is the evolutionist that is invoking anti-scientific ideas for his theory of evolution. Well, how does the evolutionist deal with that? Don't some evolutionists recognize that there's a problem here? Yes. What is the explanation that we get almost always from evolutionists? Well, the evolutionist said, now just a minute. Don't you understand that the laws of thermodynamics apply only to an isolated system, a closed system? Here you have an isolated system, no energy, nothing is being introduced from the outside. It's an isolated system. Yes, that system will run down. It becomes less and less orderly. But if the system is an open system, if you can introduce energy and material from the outside into the system, then you can build up complex things from the simple, because you don't have a closed system. You're introducing things from the outside. So that's true. You have an automobile factory, don't you? You introduce energy and material from the outside, and you have automobiles running out the other side, out the other end. It's an open system. The green plant is an open system. It can take the energy from the sun and convert it into usable energy. It's an open system. No violation of the second law because of these systems. The evolutionist says, you see, our solar system, it's an open system. Here's the earth down here. There's the sun up there. The sun is pouring down energy on the earth. Some of that energy is being trapped here on the earth, is being utilized to build up complex things from the simple. Now, within the solar system itself, yes, things are running down. Eventually, the solar system will grow cold and dark. Eventually, all the stars in the entire universe will burn out, grow cold, and all life will cease. So our universe is becoming constantly less orderly, and so is our solar system. But now, temporarily and locally, the earth is utilizing that energy being produced by the sun, which is running down. The overall net result is that the entropy of the solar system and of the universe itself is increasing. So there's no violation. Ladies and gentlemen, that is extremely naive and totally inadequate explanation. Because, you see, not only must you have an open system and an adequate energy supply, but there's two other conditions that you must have to build complex things from simple things. One, you must have an energy conversion system. You must have some motor, some machinery that will take that outside raw energy and convert it to a form of energy that can be utilized by the system. The automobile factory has that machinery. In the automobile factory, you see the machinery. The machines are there. And you bring in electrical energy, you bring in maybe natural gas or something, whatever energy you're utilizing. But you've got to have some machinery to convert that energy into a form that can be utilized within the automobile factory. The green plant has such a system. The green plant has a photosynthetic system. Through the process of photosynthesis, the green plant traps the energy, converts it into chemical energy, and uses that chemical energy to combine carbon dioxide with water and other simple chemicals and build up many, many complex things. And in addition, of course, there are many other metabolic motors in that green plant that allows the delivery of energy in the right place, at the right time, in the right amount, in the right way, that allows all of this synthetic activity to go on inside that green plant. But it has this pre-existing, extremely complex machinery, as does the automobile factory. But yet, there's one other condition that's necessary. You must have some control system. You must have something or someone operating the machinery. Now, in the automobile factory, you have an assembly line. And you have humans, or maybe you have some computerized control system that's operating that assembly line. You not only have the machinery, but you have a control system. And you have maintenance crews. Machines wear out, so you have maintenance crews that repair the machinery and eventually replace it as needed. In the green plant, the same is true. Ultimately, the control system in the green plant rests in this incredibly complex system known as the genetic system. The genetic system of the cell turns things on and turns things off, regulates all this metabolic machinery, maintains it and repairs it, and eventually replaces it. If you have these four conditions, an open system, an adequate energy supply, the metabolic motors or the energy conversion systems, and the control system, it is possible to build complex things from simple things. But only when you have these four conditions satisfied is this possible. Now, the thing is, you see, it takes machines to build machines. Machines just don't generate themselves. They just don't come into existence from disordered chemicals or disordered substances. Now, they will wear out, and they will rust, and they will go to the disordered state, but they don't spontaneously generate themselves. It takes machines to build machines, and somebody or something has to operate the machinery. Now, going back to the hypothetical primordial earth, where was the machinery? What was the machinery that took that raw, uncontrolled energy from the sun and converted it into usable form? You see, that energy coming from the sun is destructive. It's deadly. If we didn't have a layer of ozone that surrounds the earth, but filters out most of that short-range ultraviolet light, no life would be possible on the earth. You expose bacterial cells to ultraviolet light, and they're killed very quickly because ultraviolet light breaks chemical bonds. It destroys chemical substances. It snuffs out life, you see. Now, in the beginning, there were no ozone. There was no oxygen. You can't have oxygen. Impossible to have the origin of life in the presence of oxygen, because oxygen would burn up everything. Oxygen would oxidize everything. You wouldn't have anything to have life originate from. So the evolutionist has to postulate there was no oxygen. No oxygen, no ozone. And you have that ultraviolet light, which in itself is destructive, tremendously destructive and tremendously deadly. Now, if you have the protective layer of ozone that we have, and if the light that is now filtering down through that ozone layer is absorbed by the green plant, converted into chemical energy, and we eat the plants, we absorb that chemical energy, it's possible to be complex things from the simple. A little fertilized egg cell will develop into a complex human being. But that egg cell has all of that metabolic machinery. It has that incredibly complex genetic system already in existence, you see. A seed can go into a plant. But the seed has that machinery. It has this photosynthetic apparatus and other metabolic machinery. But without that, order never arises. Order always becomes disorder. Now, you and I, we're the most sophisticated machinery that we know anything about. You and I, we can't beat the second law of thermodynamics. We all eventually age, we die, and we decay to a pile of dust. You and I can't beat the second law of thermodynamics. There's a process operating in this universe that no one can beat. Now, we reproduce, we have children, so the human species is continued. Why? Because we have this tremendously complex machinery, the genetic system and the reproductive system that permits this. But individually, none of us can beat it. And finally, the universe itself, according to evolutionists, is a closed system. Now, he says, yes, a closed system will run down. And as Dr. Asimov says, the universe is becoming constantly less orderly. It's running down. It's just like a clock. It got wound up, but it's running down. But it had to get wound up in the first place, didn't it? It got wound up, and it's running down. It had to get wound up in the first place. Now, it couldn't wind itself up. Nothing in nature, nothing in natural science tells us any system can wind itself up. It can wind down, but it can't wind up. How did it get it wound up? Well, you see, we say the only rational, the only scientific explanation then is that there must be a God external to our natural universe, a supernatural God, who created the order we find within our universe. Well, people often ask, all right, but who created the Creator? Well, the only logical answer to that is just the answer the Bible gives. God never had a beginning. He has always existed. And I turn that question right around and I say, all right, if you believe in nothing but this materialistic universe, where did matter come from? Well, the only thing he could answer is, well, it's existed forever. You see, our ultimate source, whether it's God or whether it's matter, had to exist forever. There never was a time when there's absolutely nothing. Nothing can't generate something. That's another one of our laws of science. The total quantity of energy in the universe is a constant. Nothing's coming into being. Nothing is being destroyed. That means our ultimate source must have existed forever. And the Bible says precisely that. God is the I Am, the great I Am. I am I, that I am. He's the eternally existence, self-existent God. So it's scientific, it's rational to believe that there must be a God responsible. But it's unscientific to believe in this self-generating system because it's not in accord with the facts of science. Well, now, there's another matter I'd like to deal with this morning. There's many more. But about this matter of probability. Now, I think the laws of probability, if nothing else, would destroy the theory of evolution, a mechanistic, naturalistic theory of evolution. When you study the theory of evolution and what it says has happened in the light of the theory, the probabilities, you'll find that it's impossible. And evolutionists are beginning to recognize, at least some evolutionists are beginning to recognize, that the modern theory of evolution cannot be right. It's got to be wrong. Because on the basis of the laws of probability, it would take billions of times longer than 5 billion years for all these complex organisms to have arisen by the process of evolution. Now, why is this true? All right, let's forget about the origin of life for a moment. And boy, I'm telling you, when you start applying the laws of probability to the origin of life, you really run into trouble. Dr. George Wall, the famous evolutionist and biochemist, he says, just contemplating the immensity of the problem of the origin of life would say it's impossible. But he says, I'm sitting here telling you it did happen. Why? Because life exists. And you don't believe in creation, you exclude creation, you've got to believe that life evolved at least once, even though it's impossible. Some scientists now are beginning to apply the laws of probability to these postulated evolutionary processes. Now, let's start with the first cell. According to the theory of evolution, there were random changes in the genes, mutations. Now, ladies and gentlemen, mutations are chemical changes in the gene. Perhaps guanine is converted to adenine, or adenine is converted to cytosine. Some change takes place like that. Or one of these things are deleted, or others are inserted by some accidental process, some chemical process due to change in pH or some radiation, cosmic rays or x-rays or just when the cell replicates, it makes a mistake. You know, when you copy things, if you're a typist or secretary and you are copying something, sometimes you make typographical errors. Well, the cell does this too when it replicates. It makes errors. And now, not very often. It's amazing how those cells, trillions of those cells, can reproduce and replicate time after time after time, making no mistakes. But occasionally, there's a mistake made. And once that mistake is made, it's right there. It's in the genetic apparatus and passed on to the offspring, and you have a mutation. Now, according to the theory of evolution, according to modern theory of evolution, they say most of these mutations are harmful, they're pathological, they're injurious. But just by chance, just fortuitously, rarely one of these mutations proves to be beneficial. It brings about a change in some characteristic of the plant or animal that just happens to be beneficial, or at least it's potentially beneficial. Maybe in the present environment it's neutral or injurious, but eventually should a new environment arise, there's a new opportunity to exploit, somehow this accidental change equipped that plant or animal to be to survive better in this changed environment. And as a result, it reproduces in larger numbers, makes a greater contribution to the next generation. And this is repeated generation after generation. The mutant makes a greater contribution to the gene pool than the succeeding, than the wild type, than the unchanged kind. And eventually, because of this, it replaces the original kind. And so you have a change or an evolution. And they say that these mutations are very slight. They bring about changes that are imperceptible or almost imperceptible. And so you need to have an awful lot of these extremely rare mutations scattered through millions of years, you see, or hundreds of thousands of years to bring about evolution. Now, mutations themselves are rather rare. They don't happen frequently. I mean, our genetic apparatus is very sound and it does things real good and very faithfully. But occasionally there is a mutation. And by the way, there's many repair mechanisms. Mutations occur, there's repair mechanisms inside the body, inside the cell that repairs those mutations, restores the gene to its original state. Now, obviously, you didn't have those things operating on the primitive Earth. You didn't have any repair mechanism. I don't know what happened to the genetic material back in those days. You didn't have any repair mechanism. You got to have these repair mechanisms or the DNA will go to pot. That's all there is to it. They occur so rapidly. Well, anyhow, so you have all these slight changes accumulating through great stretches of time. Now, listen. Natural selection is not a random process. Natural selection works in bringing the environment into the organism into harmony with the environment and so forth. It selects, you see, the favorable changes and works in such a way. It's not a random process. And the biologist gets the idea that this evolutionary process is not a random process. It's an orderly, directed process that is influenced and directed by natural selection. But you see, natural selection can only select. It can't create anything. It has to wait until the mutation process has produced what is needed. The mutation process itself is a random process. Ultimately, the evolutionary process is totally dependent upon random processes, random changes. Let me see if I can illustrate it this way. Supposing you're a bridge player. And you say, now, I need one particular deal, just one unique arrangement of the cards. So you hand a deck of cards to your friend, and you say, shuffle the cards and deal out the cards. And I'm going to wait for that deal. So you hand the cards to your friend, and after about 359,644,399,000,000 and so many thousands, you finally got the deal that you wanted. Because you see, if that friend of yours is shuffling those cards faithfully as a random process, he's got to deal out those cards in a random fashion. And you've just got to wait for the laws of probability to produce the deal you want. Now, the chance would be practically nil. You're going to get it in the first deal. But you might get it after 1,000 deals. But on the other hand, the laws of probability say you probably have to wait about 360 trillion deals. Now, you might have to wait for a lot more than that. But if the laws of probability operate, and this process occurs time after time after time, you make your prediction strictly on the basis of probability. All right, finally you get the deal you want, and so you select it. Now, selection may be instantaneous in this case. It doesn't take any time. Now, selection in nature would take a lot more time than that, but you make your selection. You say, okay, now I'm ready for the next deal I need. Now, I need a particular deal, and you describe what deal you want, and you hand your deck of cards. Of course, you've worn out an awful lot of cards before this time. And so he starts this process all over again. And you have to sit there and you wait for many millions of years. Finally, you get the deal that you want again. And so you continue. Now, you see, that's the way evolution is supposed to work. The process generating the mutations is strictly fortuitous, strictly accidental, strictly random. Nothing can say. You see, the characteristic, the animal, he can't say, now look, you genes down there, the environment changed, and I need this particular characteristic, so you get busy, and you produce what I need. Those genes are just dumb things. They don't hear anything. They don't speak. They don't hear. And chemicals and ultraviolet light just act in random fashions. It might hit the guanine down here in position 1,892. It might hit adenine up here at position 642. They're just dumb things. And so all these random changes are produced. Well, now, some mathematicians who are evolutionists, they're not creationists, and they didn't set out to prove creation or disprove evolution, they got to thinking about this. Well, now, the basic evolutionary process is dependent upon these random mutations. So randomness, the random processes, are the very fundamental of evolution. And they begin to apply the laws of probability to this process. You need so many changes, and so forth and so on, and you have a certain mutation rate, and so forth and so on, and you apply the laws of probability, all this process. And they fit all this information in their computers and ask the question, how long would this process take to produce a complex organ of some kind? Or, ultimately, you might say, how long would it take to convert some primitive cell into man? The answer came back, billions of times longer than billions of years. Well, as a result, they began to discuss some of these problems with some of their evolutionary biologist friends. And they said, look, there's something wrong with your theory. It just won't work. Modern theory of evolution is impossible. Well, you know, the biologists didn't like that a bit. And so they had some real heated discussions. Well, the Wistar Institute in Philadelphia got wind of this controversy, so they invited about six of these mathematicians and 25 of the world's leading evolutionary biologists to the Wistar Institute so they could scrap it out eyeball to eyeball. And so the mathematicians made their case, and the evolutionary biologists came back and said, well, you people don't know me, you don't understand this, or maybe you've forgotten this, or so forth and so on. And so they had all this discussion. And the Wistar Institute published the results of this symposium in a book called Mathematical Challenges to the Neo-Darwinian Interpretation of Evolution, edited by P.S. Moorhead and M.M. Kaplan, published in 1967. Now, one of the mathematicians present was Dr. Murray Eden of MIT. Ladies and gentlemen, you know, you don't become a professor at MIT by just being an average, run-of-the-mill professor. You have to be really top-notch. Dr. Eden is a brilliant scientist. Now, I'm convinced he knows a lot more about biology than those biologists know about probability theory. He wrote one of the chapters. He's one of the mathematicians there, and he has two chapters in this book. One of his chapters is called Inadequacies of Neo-Darwinian Evolution as a Scientific Theory. And in that chapter on page 109, Dr. Eden makes the following statement. Quote, it is our contention that if random is given a serious and crucial interpretation from a probabilistic point of view, the randomness postulate is highly implausible. And that an adequate scientific theory of evolution must await the discovery and elucidation of new natural laws, physical, chemical, and biological. Unquote. So Dr. Eden said, now this idea of random mutations, this idea of randomness, is highly implausible, and that an adequate scientific theory of evolution must await the discovery and elucidation of new natural laws. What is he saying? The modern neo-Darwinian theory of evolution is totally inadequate to explain anything more than just trivial changes. And an adequate scientific theory must await the discovery of some new laws. But we're confident they're never going to discover any such new laws, physical, chemical, or otherwise. There are no other such laws operating in this world today. We know what scientific principles are operating. And Dr. Eden says, on basis of what we know, this modern theory of evolution is impossible. On the basis of what we know right now. Well, you see, this is something creation's been saying all the time. But evolution has just sneered at the creationists. But now here is an evolutionist saying the same thing. It's just impossible. It won't work that way. It'll never work. The laws of probability operating against any such mechanistic, naturalistic process. Let me just give you some idea of the probability factors that are at work. If I had another lecture schedule, I could relate this to the origin of life, the origin of protein molecules and so forth and so on. Now, the origin of life and the origin of complex things require the ordered sequence of certain units. In a protein, you have to have amino acids arranged in a precise sequence. In human growth hormone, you have 188 amino acids. There's 20 different kinds, so you might say the protein language has about 20 letters. And you have to arrange these 20 letters in a certain sequence to get human growth hormone. 188 times it has to be done. And in the beginning, you probably wouldn't have to have 188, but you'd have to have a lot of these. Might take 100, might take 60, might take 80. These amino acids would have to be arranged in a precise order. Just like the letters in the English alphabet would have to be arranged in precise order. Here, now we have a message here in the English language. And it's the words are spelled, the sentence are written, and the message is written by arranging the letters in a precise order. Now, for example, here is a sentence and it makes a certain statement. It says, these again are obvious transitions that could be easily traced in the fossil record. Now, there's only one way that you can spell that, make that sentence. You have to arrange those letters in precisely that order. The same thing is true of a protein molecule. If you're going to have human growth hormone, you have to arrange those amino acids in a precise order. Or hemoglobin, or some other molecule that has to be arranged in that precise order. Now, according to the theory of evolution, it's just been done by random processes. But given enough time, you see, they say it would have happened. Now, the mathematicians say no. The laws are probably against that ever happening, even in 5 billion years, even billions of times longer than 5 billion years. Well, now, a protein molecule may have hundreds. But let's get it down to a more simple level. I like to use this example, 17. 17. Supposing you had to arrange 17 amino acids in a certain order to get some certain compound. Now, that's not enough to have a protein. You've got to need a lot more than that. But let's just take 17. What would be the probability of getting the one you want if you had to do this by a random process, just by chance? Well, let me illustrate it this way. Suppose I ask 17 of you people to line up here in a certain order. Then you go out that door and come back in again and rearrange yourself in a different order. Go out that door again, come back in, rearrange yourself in a different order. Go out that door again and keep going out that door time after time after time, but never going out that door twice in the same order. How many times do you think 17 people go out that door, but never go out that door twice in the same order? Thousands? Tens of thousands? Hundreds of thousands? Few million? Well, actually, 17 people could go out that door almost 356 trillion times and never go out that door twice in the same order. Nearly 356 trillion times. You don't believe me? All right, you get 16 of your friends together, that's me, and you try. Well, it'd be a little easier. Go to the computer, 17 factorial, which is nearly 356 trillion. Now, supposing I wrote your name down in a certain order. You didn't know what the order was. And I said, okay, you line up now. And try to see if you can get the order I have here. You'd have one chance out of 356 trillion of getting the one that I have here, you see. Well, you know, that's, you know, in billions of years, that might happen, 356 trillion. But then you'd only get one molecule. You'd only get one. You need billions of tons of this stuff. And you need many, many different kinds of molecules. And 17 is extremely simple. What if you need 100 amino acids arranged in a certain order? Well, then you come in a different order of probability. What about 100? Well, supposing I had a sentence here that has 100 letters in it. Now, I've used just 20 out of the 26 letters of the English alphabet. That makes the probability a little greater. So we have a sentence here with 20 different letters, 100 different letters. Okay? Now, it's just this is the only sentence we're looking for. We're not looking for just any other sentence. We're looking for precisely this sentence. Now, supposing I gave a monkey a typewriter, and I let that monkey type away for 5 billion years. Let's say he types a sentence every second for 5 billion years. What would be the probability that monkey would type precisely this sentence with no spelling errors? Think he might have a good chance? 5 billion years is an awful long time. And he repeats it every second for 5 billion years. Pretty good chance? Well, let me put it this way. Let's take this earth, and let's cover this earth elbow to elbow and eyeball to eyeball with monkeys. We have no space left over. Every square foot of earth is covered with monkeys. And we give every one of these monkeys a typewriter. But much more than that, we're going to take another billion planets the same size as the earth, and we're going to cover every one of those billion planets with monkeys, elbow to elbow and eyeball to eyeball, and we're going to give every one of those monkeys a typewriter. And every one of these monkeys is going to type a sentence every second for 5 billion years. What are the chances that one of these monkeys, just one now, or more, would have typed precisely that sentence with no spelling errors? The chances are nil. I mean, it's essentially nil that one of those monkeys would have done it. Why? Because the number of different ways you can arrange 100 letters, 20 different kinds, is so immense that the number of different tries those monkeys could make in 5 billion years is vanishingly small. It's equated with zero. The number of different ways you can arrange those letters is 10 to the 130th power. The number of tries all those monkeys could make is 10 to the 41st power. And 10 to the 41st power is essentially zero when you compare it to 10 to the 130th power. Now, 10 to the 41st power is not approximately one-third of 10 to the 130th. I'll clue you in on that if you don't know exponentials. If you take 10 to the 130th power and subtract 10 to the 41st power, you can equate it to 10 to the 130th power. You haven't even made a dent. In other words, that number is so immense that the number of tries the monkeys could make would be so small, so minute, in comparison to the total number of possibilities, that the chances that one of those monkeys would have hit that sentence correctly is essentially nil. It is below the impossibility threshold, as the scientists say, as the mathematicians say. It is below the impossibility threshold. It's just vanishingly small. But supposing by some miracle one monkey did do it, again, he'd only get one molecule, you see. And we got to have billions of tons of different molecules, and we need many different kinds of molecules. And of course, that doesn't explain how the molecules got together, does it? And formed all this tremendous metabolic system. Well, when you consider, when you come to grips with the probability factors, in the light of what the theory postulates, you find it's impossible. Well, now, ladies and gentlemen, that doesn't prove creation, does it? But it simply proves, I believe, one thing: it would never have happened mechanistically and naturalistically. Now, what we're saying is that the origin of these extremely complex molecules and living things did require an intelligent, purposeful creator. They could not have generated themselves. They could not have come into existence by natural processes. Now, we can go in the laboratory and we can put molecules together. We can put amino acids together to make these protein-like molecules. And I spent many years of my research involved in this sort of thing, synthesizing protein-like molecules. And it was hard work. And you get a lot of junk along with the pure product that you have to eliminate by your purification procedures. It's hard work, and it's not easy. Even organic chemists, and maybe many of us were involved in this, a concentrated effort, try to put these things together. But it doesn't happen naturally. It will never happen. What will happen when you take one of these complex molecules, it tends to be just falls apart. That's what happened. They never come together spontaneously, naturally, but they do fall apart. So we see that on the basis of no natural processes, then we say it could not have happened mechanistically, then the only thing left is creation, you see, by an intelligent creator. An omniscient, omnipotent, intelligent creator was necessary.